From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And let's get right to our top story, the unrest in Baltimore, where extra National Guard troops are being sent to support those deployed after a night of violence that saw stores looted, police injured, buildings and police cars burned.
The rioting followed the funeral of Freddie Gray, the black man who died after police detained him. Schools are closed in Baltimore today. The city's mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, is responding to criticism that she said, quote, she'd made space for people to destroy things. She said that was taken out of context. She was talking about the delicate balancing act of protecting protesters' right to free speech, and that while we try to make sure they were protected from cars and other things, we also gave those who wished to destroy space to do that as well. In other words, it was a tactical error. So what's the mood in Baltimore today? NPR's Eder Peralta is there. Eder, your sense of the city.
Well, I mean, right now it's completely different than yesterday, obviously. I mean, there's a huge crowd of people gathered right now at what was the epicenter of the riots yesterday, except that right now they're not protesting. They're cleaning up, and there's lots of people with brooms. There's lots of people with plastic bags. And, you know, one of them told me, isn't it ironic that the same people who destroyed this place are now helping to clean it up?
Well, what more do we know about how it started, how it snowballed yesterday? There were reports that there was some social media chatter about a purge, seen as a reference to the film in which one day a year people were allowed to commit crime, including murder, and that police then reacted to that by telling people to start shutting down businesses. What do we know about what's true there?
I think what we actually know is that police did put out a statement earlier yesterday that they believed that gangs had made a pact with each other to try and hurt police officers. Now, also, what I've heard on the ground is that what happened is that high school kids were let out of school and the transit system was shut down. And so you had a sort of critical mass of very young people who started throwing things at police. It's hard to tell. I mean, there was chatter about that call on social media that people sort of go out and act lawlessly. But I haven't seen very many credible reports that had a huge effect.
Well, in any event, Eder, what are people saying today? We've heard people invoking Martin Luther King, saying that riot is the language of the unheard. But on the other hand, you know, we saw images of mothers, one running and grabbing her son literally by the ear and dragging him away from the violence yesterday. So what are people saying?
I think I heard two different things. Yesterday, it was a day where I heard a lot of people saying that this was the only way that they were going to have their voices heard by the city and the government and the country. And then today, I saw a lot of tears. I saw this one liquor store that had been, you know, completely ransacked, and it was, the windows were broken, everything had been taken, and I saw, you know, at least five people come over, hug the owner, and say, I'm sorry. And, you know, I saw tears. And one mother who was there told me that she was going to bring her 11-year-old son to see this so that history wouldn't repeat itself. As you know, the last time that this community saw riots this big was in 1968, following the death of Martin Luther King.
Well, are you hearing that it's in part a generational thing? Because we've heard a lot of people who were there in 68 saying it took us, you know, decades to rebuild after that. And now these young people, as you said, coming out of school, don't understand that that's not, that violence isn't protest and we have to build again. Is it a generational thing?
I did hear that. I heard it from the oldest member of the Arch Social Club, which is a club that hosts dances and music. And he was 91 years old. And what he said is that in his day, and he's lived in this neighborhood for basically his whole entire life, and he said that in his day, they respected police, and he doesn't think that that's the case for young people. Now, on the other hand, I spoke to another young man. He was 26 years old, and he was helping to clean up today. And he actually put a positive spin on all of this. He said that this wasn't just the young people, that he had seen, you know, the older folks and his parents' generation come together in the violence from yesterday. Yeah. And he thought that was a positive thing.
NPR's digital reporter who's been in Baltimore overnight. Ader, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we remember that the situation in Baltimore became what it is thanks to a cell phone video of Freddie Gray being dragged into a police vehicle. It was also video from a bystander that sparked outrage over a police officer shooting a fleeing Walter Scott in the back in North Charleston, South Carolina. For a police perspective on being taped and also taping suspects on their own cameras, we're joined by Kelvin Wright, the police chief in Chesapeake, Virginia. He was one of the first police chiefs to equip his officers with body cameras back in 2009. And Chief Wright, do you think it's a good thing that citizens are videotaping police officers?
Well, I think that it is a sign of the times. I think to some degree, yes, it is a good thing. You know, it's citizens' right to record what they see as long as they do not interfere with an officer's lawful duties. For instance, the one that took place in Baltimore and the one that took place in North Charleston, as you can see, they were taken from a distance. And I think that it helps us, you know, clear a case very quickly and helps us, you know, investigate the matter quickly as well.
On the other hand, do you have concerns that if these videos come out and are made public, in the court of public opinion, these officers can be basically found guilty before they are able to present perhaps another video or different evidence of what exactly took place?
And that's perhaps one legitimate concern. I think that that's why officers should perhaps be wearing body-worn cameras, because they can show what led up to the event. The way our system is designed, 30 seconds prior to the camera being activated is recorded in buffer. So it does give you some context, and context is important.
Why did you decide back in 2009 to equip your officers with body cameras? This was long before any of the current news came out, and Michael Brown and Eric Garner in Staten Island and all these other cases, you decided to do this quite a while ago.
Yes. Well, for us, it was not so much about allegations of abuse. They actually stem from complaints of officers being rude or being crude. And you would always have it where it was an officer's word against the citizens or a citizen's word against the officer. And it just left me feeling incomplete, not being able to get to the final conclusion as to whether something did or did not take place. Plus, we had members of the NAACP who often said that they felt that officers' conduct needed to be observed. And certainly, I thought this was the logical step to do so.
And did you face any pushback from your officers?
Just initially, I think that the number of the officers, very small percentage of them, did not like the idea of an all-seeing camera or what they think is an all-seeing camera invading, you know, their daily routine. But I think that because of the manner in which we prescribe this usage, plus the fact that a great number of officers have had complaints against them, cleared very quickly, and the officers' actions exonerated, I think that they have clearly bought into it.
One of the concerns, though, about them is just who has access to that video. Do you get a flood of requests for the video that's coming from those body cams? And do you always grant them when you do?
We have had requests, and we do not grant them. For the most part, we treat these videos as if they are evidence, and for the most part, they are. So which means the people who are entitled to them are the Commonwealth's attorney and the defense attorney, and the individual who is involved in the video. And I think that that's a good approach to take. Virginia's law is absolutely has not been, you know, clarified right now, but we follow the FOIA guidelines.
How much do you think that cameras have changed the behavior of police?
I think that for us, it clearly has worked to our advantage, because it gives the officer some caution to make sure that their actions that they're taking are indeed proper, and they know that somebody's going to probably look at it in retrospect and critique what they've done. I also think that to some degree, it may indeed curtail or have some type of regulatory ability over citizens if they know that they're being recorded as well.
How do your officers feel about citizens recording them with their cell phones?
I'm certain that some of the officers do not like it, but that's a citizen's constitutional right, and I support it.
What do you think when you see other police forces where they're not using body cameras? Do you think to yourself, if only they were doing what I've been doing, they wouldn't have these problems?
When I see that some agencies are not using them, I see that they have missed an opportunity to serve the officer's interest, the department's interest, and certainly the public's interest. For instance, the Michael Brown incident. I think that if an officer was wearing a body-worn camera at that time, can you imagine what the value of that would have been in able to be able to prove or disprove what actually took place? I think that as it becomes more prolific and that body-worn cameras become the norm, I think that we and law enforcement will be the better for it, and I think society will see the benefits of it as well.
That's Calvin Wright, the police chief in Chesapeake, Virginia. He was one of the first police chiefs to equip his officers with body cameras. That was back in 2009. He actually started using dashboard cams as an officer back in the 1990s. Chief Wright, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, and as we continue to follow developments in Baltimore and Nepal, there is another big story today at the Supreme Court. Oral arguments on the issue of same-sex marriage in a case that could lead to the legalization of same-sex marriage across the country. If it does, it would be a case for the history books. Michael Klarman is a professor at Harvard Law School. His most recent book is From the Closet to the Altar: Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And what are your thoughts on this case? Where does it rank among other landmark civil rights cases that have come before the Supreme Court?
Well, we don't know what the outcome is, but it seems pretty likely that there are 5 votes in favor of a federal constitutional right for same-sex marriage. And if that's what the court decides, this will be the equivalent of Brown versus Board of Education to the gay rights movement.
And let's talk about that. Take us back to 1954 and Brown versus Board of Education, which is acknowledged as one of the greatest Supreme Court decisions of the 20th century. This one unanimously held that the racial segregation of children in public schools violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
Right. So there are a couple important things to understand about Brown. It's unanimous, and it strikes us today as obviously right. It's important to note as well that there's no chance the Supreme Court would have decided such a case 10 or 20 years earlier. By the summer of 1954, half the country agreed with Brown, but that's because of profound racial changes that were set in motion or accelerated by World War II, and the justices deciding the case completely understood that. So if such a case had been brought 20 years earlier, the justices almost certainly would have rejected the claim. That's quite analogous to gay marriage. The Supreme Court would not have ruled in favor 10 years ago when the Massachusetts court was the only one in the country ruling that there was such a right. And even 2 years ago, the Supreme Court was unwilling to tackle the issue. They ducked it in the Proposition 8 case from California.
Because they want to follow public opinion on issues?
Right. So one way to think about this is there's a spectrum of court decisions relative to public opinion, and the court very rarely, if ever, gets way in front. Sometimes it'll decide an issue when the country's split down the middle. That's Brown versus Board of Education. That's Roe versus Wade, the abortion decision. Even more frequently, the court will come along towards the end of the social movement, after there's already been tremendous change, after a majority of people have already decided that they support the change, and then this court will suppress the remaining outliers. It will impose a rule on the entire country that most people have already evolved in the direction of supporting. And gay marriage is actually closer to that. Today, we've got 60% in favor. Even among people who oppose it, they don't have the same adamant resistance that they did years ago. This will be an example of the Supreme Court. I don't want to say it's a mopping up operation. We haven't moved that far along the spectrum. But it's also not an example of the court intervening when the country's still split down the middle. It's not split down the middle anymore.
Well, and just as evidence of the fact that the court doesn't like to get out in front of public opinion, is the case from 1857 the worst, or at least one of the worst decisions that many people would say the Supreme Court has ever made, Dred Scott? And we're talking about the case in which the Supreme Court ruled that Americans of African descent were not American citizens and could not sue in federal court.
Right. So Dred Scott has 2 issues. One, whether a free black person can sue under the federal constitution in federal court. And the other is whether Congress has the power to forbid slavery in federal territories. We regard Dred Scott today as an egregious decision because they said even free blacks are not really qualified to be citizens of the United States, and because the court said that Congress doesn't have the power to bar slavery. At the time, the decision was probably more popular than not with most Americans. I don't think most people recognize that today. The reason why the decision is seen as egregious is because 4 years later, there was a civil war, opinion changed dramatically, and Congress passed a constitutional amendment barring slavery. But when the court decided the case, I think it's almost certainly true that more Americans than not supported what the court had done. We tend to view these judgments a little ahistorically, the same point about Brown. And you're going to see a similar movement with gay marriage, given the models that predict continued evolution, 1%, 2% a year, each year increasingly support gay marriage. Within another 10 or 20 years, Americans are going to overwhelmingly support a decision in favor of same-sex marriage, which might be kind of tempting for some of the justices who care about their historical reputations.
Well, another case that many people have compared this one to is Roe versus Wade. I want to take you back to 1973 when that decision came out. Here was Walter Cronkite on the CBS News that evening.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy during the first 3 months belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government. Thus, the anti-abortion laws of 46 states were rendered unconstitutional.
Michael Klarman, do you compare this case to Roe v. Wade at all?
I love hearing Walter Cronkite's voice, such an important part of my childhood. It's not quite like Roe. So what the Supreme Court did in Roe was say, essentially, as Walter Cronkite said, 46 states in the way they regulated abortion was now unconstitutional. If the Supreme Court rules in favor of gay marriage, it's saying that what is today the law in 37 states, 36 or 37 states, is going to be the law of the land and applicable in the remaining 13 states. The other difference is in Roe, opinion on abortion had changed dramatically, but just in a few years, and nobody really knew what the resistance was going to be. You just have to go back 5 years before Roe, and only 15% of Americans supported abortion as a right. That grew very quickly, and there were opinion polls suggesting it might have been as much as 60% at the time of Roe. But that was misleading, and in fact, on Roe versus Wade, opinion was pretty much divided down the middle, and it didn't continue to evolve in the direction of liberalization. There's reason to think gay marriage is not like that. Gay marriage is something that young people overwhelmingly support, and it's something where people have very direct impressions based on whether they have friends and family and loved ones who've come out of the closet. Abortion doesn't quite work that way because people who have abortion still keep it secret. So people who oppose abortion, it's still an abstract issue. They don't know about their friends and neighbors and loved ones who've had abortions, but they do know when their children come out of the closet and announce that they're gay or lesbian and then want to marry the person they love. Some issues more directly affect the people who oppose the court decision. If you oppose Brown, you don't want your kids going to school with African-American children. But if you oppose a gay marriage decision, it's not going to change your life in a very direct way. It means that the couple down the street that are already living together are going to get a marriage license, but that's not really going to affect you very directly in your life. So there isn't going to be the same kind of resistance, and opinion's going to continue most likely to evolve in the direction of greater toleration.
One more case I want to ask you about in comparison to today's case before the court, and that is Loving versus Virginia from 1967. This was about Virginia's law that prevented marriages between persons solely on the basis of racial classifications. Is this one comparable to that one, interracial marriage?
There's some very direct connections. The Supreme Court, after Brown, ducked on the issue of interracial marriage. They had a case before them the following year. They decided that they were not going to rule on the issue because they were afraid it would be too explosive. In the mid-1950s, 90% of Americans told pollsters they opposed interracial marriage. So the court refused to decide the case until 13 years later. And finally, in 1967, they ruled that, of course, the Constitution doesn't allow bans on interracial marriage. That decision produced a yawn of indifference. Even though there were opinion polls still showing that most Americans opposed it, the percentage had gone down pretty significantly. And again, it just doesn't affect people's lives that directly in the same way that the same-sex marriage issue is not going to affect the lives of people who oppose same-sex marriage because it's not going to affect their marriages. But I do see this as very similar because the court on this issue of same-sex marriage has also delayed for a period of years their willingness to intervene. There now looks like they're going to intervene. mean they've kind of been forced to do so by the circuit split in the Sixth Circuit. And it seems likely there are going to be at least 5 votes in favor. And it's not going to be a yawn of indifference, but it's not going to produce anywhere near the sort of backlash that opponents are predicting. They're trying to convince the court this is like Roe versus Wade. You're going to have 40 years of continued resistance and the issue's never going to go away. And it's just not the same issue.
But at least 5 votes in favor on a case like this, wouldn't you as a legal scholar prefer to have closer to unanimous decision?
Sure. A decision is going to seem more firmly grounded if there's something closer to unanimity. The justices in Brown created artificial unanimity. There were justices who didn't agree, but they went along for the good of the court. That's a manifestation of weakness. The justices understood there was going to be tremendous resistance in the South. The court's changed in 60 years. You're not going to get that sort of fake unanimity anymore, that artificial unanimity. And the court's not going to need it because there isn't going to be massive resistance. 10 years after Brown, literally not a single school had been desegregated in Mississippi. And the plaintiff in the first school desegregation suit in Mississippi was Medgar Evers, who was assassinated within 6 months of having his name on the litigation papers. You're not going to see anywhere near that sort of resistance. You know, in Alabama, you have gay marriages taking place in Birmingham and Montgomery, and that's the core of the Deep South. And in those cities, there just isn't that much resistance. Maybe in rural Alabama, it would be a different sort of story. So I just don't think you're going to see that sort of resistance.
That's Michael Klarman, a professor at Harvard Law School and author of From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage, as we watch what's happening at the Supreme Court today. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The death toll has risen to more than 5,000 after Saturday's earthquake in Nepal. Humanitarian aid has started to reach the capital, Kathmandu, but villages are unreachable. Jeffrey Shannon is director of programs for Mercy Corps in Nepal. He's in Kathmandu. And Jeffrey, what are you hearing about those villages?
We were speaking to some people just today, actually, and one of them said it very eloquently, that this is a crisis of unknowns. Quite frankly, it was unexpected, of course, on Saturday when the earthquake hit. A lot of our staff were out in the field, some on holiday visiting families. So we very quickly got some messages back as staff started to check in to let us know that they were okay. It's just devastating, some of the stories they had, where entire villages have simply ceased to exist. There's nothing left standing in these places. And on top of that, we're in a hilly, mountainous area. So this earthquake was the first devastation. That was followed very quickly by landslides. And now we've got very unseasonable rains pouring down on people who simply have no place, no shelter to stay in.
Now, do you have any idea how many people this cuts off?
We really hesitate to say, because as soon as we give a number, there are villages that, for all intents and purposes, they're just invisible. They're not on maps. They don't have any connection. And part of our job is to go out and find these people. Right now, we're seeing figures from Kathmandu, of course, and even this is very unreliable because we've got really tall buildings, very ancient buildings that have crumbled down. The search and rescue teams are going out and simply finding people as they can. In the villages, then, we've got, even before the earthquake, problems of accessibility. These are areas that you walk for days to get to them in the first place under the best of times. And this is certainly not one of the best of times.
No. Meantime, what are you seeing in Kathmandu? You know, just it feels as if the loss is just incalculable.
It's hard to wrap your head around it, actually. As for what I see right now, well, I was sitting in the dark just a few minutes before you called and we turned on the generator. But in our compound, some of our neighbors, the houses have been destroyed or they're so risky. People are afraid to go back in because they could still collapse. So we've got about 30 people sleeping here under some tarpaulin in our compound. And about 20 feet away to my right, there's a group of between 50 and 100 people. The population changes as people come and go. Just sitting, sleeping, eating under tarp. And it's quite cold tonight. We've had a rain throughout the day as well. And people are simply sleeping rough.
The concern has been the diseases that might follow an earthquake when there's not fresh water. What are you seeing?
Exactly that. The government's now started to, and the private sector have started to provide water trucks in some of the areas. And people are desperate. They don't have access to water. They're in the open air. Plus, a lot of these buildings that have collapsed, a lot of that material is now up in the air. We're quite sure that we're going to start to see some upper respiratory problems coming up, especially in the very old and the very young. people aren't able to wash their hands, wash their clothes, to shower. There are no toilets around. Of course, these are open public areas. All of these things combined, not to mention the losses themselves, lives lost during the earthquake, these will all contribute to disease in the coming days and weeks.
Yeah. Jeffrey Shannon, Director of Programs for Mercy Corps in Nepal, in Kathmandu. Jeffrey, thank you so much for the work that you and other aid workers do, and stay safe.
And thank you for following this story. We really appreciate it.
Lots of news to follow today, but nature marches on. Spring peepers, little frogs, the result of a massive migration on a handful of nights with a cast of millions of amphibians. It's a story I've missed every year for a decade, but New Hampshire Public Radio's Sam Evans Brown timed it just right.
Wow, they're really coming early. Everyone's excited for a big night.
Brett Thielen is the science director at the Harris Center for Conservation Education in Hancock, New Hampshire. And on a recent evening, she was the tour guide to Big Night. Generally speaking, Big Night is the first rainy spring night after the ground has thawed and the air is in the 40s.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of salamanders and frogs all moving at the same time en masse to their breeding pools. And it's just exquisite. And most people don't even know that it's happening.
And on these nights, Thielen and other salamander enthusiasts point out anyone behind the wheel of a car may be flattening hundreds of amphibians.
We have organized volunteers, the Salamander Crossing Brigades, who come out and they basically are going to walk back and forth down this stretch of road looking for frogs and salamanders that are trying to cross, and they're going to move them across by hand.
Be gentle, don't drop.
Make sure.
Hey, honey. Thielen coordinates about 100 volunteers at more than a dozen crossings throughout southwestern New Hampshire. She keeps a 5-day salamander forecast, and when conditions are right, she mobilizes her crew a few times a year. They set up salamander crossing signs at crossing hotspots and patrol the road with headlamps and buckets. In New England, the star of Big Night amphibians is the spotted salamander. They're black with orangey-yellow spots and around 6 inches long. Chances are you haven't seen one before because, though they can live to be 20 years old, they spend 95% of their life underground.
And so when people see a spotted salamander, it really blows their mind.
Thielen remembers a young family that drove through the crossing slowly, but then the car stopped abruptly and the father leapt out.
And he said, I've lived here 28 years. I have never seen this. I've never seen it. And he was getting ready to pull his toddler out of her car seat right in the middle of the road to see it because he was so excited.
The thing that you find is as you learn more about them, particularly when you learn to spot them on the roads during spring migration, it makes you not want to drive your car.
David Patrick works with the Nature Conservancy.
And roads, you know, roads are a problem for an incredible variety of biodiversity, but amphibians and reptiles, these slow-moving species that need to move between wetlands and uplands, you know, they're some of the organisms we're most worried about.
Patrick points to one study that found on quiet roads, around 10% of amphibians get run over. But on busy roads, it's more like 50%.
But we tend to say, well, you know, they're still there. Why worry? You know, they haven't gone extinct yet. You know, without getting too far off topic, I think one of the problems we have with sort of conservation and the way that we manage and consider biodiversity is that we worry about the rare stuff, which we absolutely should be doing. But we're a little bit less worried about the common stuff. And I think we should be worried about the common stuff, too.
Frogs and salamanders produce huge numbers of eggs and offspring, the vast majority of which are eaten by other animals. So squashing a quarter of them on the roads before they can reproduce shrinks that foundation of the food chain.
Who wants to pick up the big frog?
Sky, you want to get the big frog?
Brett Thielen's crossing brigades have brought these amphibians to safety. Now it's time to sit back and listen to the frogs in their pools and puddles as they sing and try to reel in a mate for this spring. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Evans Brown in New Hampshire.
And Sam is part of the Here and Now Collaborative. But Jeremy, meanwhile, look, there is the spotted salamander. Mm. Doesn't it look like the toys that kids used to have where they have little vinyl circles they put on? We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. But it's just one of the great things to see. And yes, people hand carry them across the street, dramatically stop traffic. But in some places, in Western Mass, for instance, they've built underground tunnels just for the salamander to cross the street. Well, again, pictures at hereandnow.org.
Well, in Miami, a month-long poetry festival is wrapping up. It is called Oh Miami. It's been going on for the month of April, which is National Poetry Month. You may have heard about one of the projects there called Zip Odes, which allows people to create poems based on their zip codes. Joining us now to talk about some of the other highlights is Scott Cunningham. He is the founder and director of Oh Miami. He's with us from WLRN. Scott, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And the goal of Oh Miami, we see on your website, is for every single person in Miami-Dade County to encounter a poem during the month of April. Do you think you'll be successful?
We will probably fail, but we will fail victoriously.
And why do you want that to be the case? Why do you want everybody to see a poem? What is it about poetry that you want all these people in Miami-Dade County to know?
Well, we believe poetry is the most democratic art form. There's no financial barrier to do it. It doesn't require any sort of equipment or even really much in the way of education. We met a woman a couple years ago who's illiterate and writes poems in her head. So we feel the genre is a really powerful tool for people to engage in culture. And by taking on this mission, we're really trying to change the audience for poetry and point out the fact that it's a genre that a lot of people do engage in, but you don't necessarily hear about it.
Well, and this year you've had a number of projects, including one called Zip Odes, which we've heard about. But tell us more about some of the other things you've been doing this year.
One of the more fun ones was we invited an artist down from Brooklyn named Ian Thomas to write a series of poems using gold leaf painting. And we put them on urinals in various places in Miami-Dade County. So we called the project Murinals. And and Ian went around for 3 days and wrote poems in men's restrooms.
You've also got a project this year that enlists dogs to wear scarves with a line of poetry.
That's correct. We asked a poet named Melanie Almeter to give us a project, and she came up with Oh My Animals, which is a project that puts a line of Emily Dickinson on dog bandanas. And so we distributed about 2,500 of them all over Miami and, you know, mostly at places where dogs gather, like shelters and boarding houses and things like that.
But basically the point here is, with this and other projects you're doing, just to get poetry everywhere.
Yeah, we really want to propagate the idea that poetry is already everywhere and we're just pointing it out. And that it's something that's fun and is pleasurable, and it's not an assignment that you're going to get graded on.
What made you think that originally?
You know, I thought that as a kid, and then like a lot of people, I forgot it. I actually think doing the festival made me really realize it. You know, like a lot of people, I have a graduate degree in poetry, and you know, I was very focused on just getting my own work out there. But through doing the festival, I've met so many people who don't identify as professional poets, but for whom poetry is a really important part of their lives. And it really changed my perspective on my own genre.
Well, can you leave us with a poem?
Okay. I'll do my best. I'm going to be reciting this from memory. One of my favorite poets is a guy named Donald Justice, who grew up in Miami and then moved away. So this is Donald Justice's There is a Gold Light in Certain Old Paintings. There is a gold light in certain old paintings that represents a diffusion of sunlight. It is like happiness when we are happy. It is everywhere and nowhere at once, this light, and the poor soldiers huddled at the foot of the cross, sharing its charity equally with the cross. Orpheus hesitated beside the Black River. With so much to look forward to, he looked back. We think he sang then, but the song is lost. At least he had seen once more the beloved back. I say the song went this way. Oh, prolong now the suffering, if that is all there is to prolong. The world is very dusty, uncle. Let us work. One day the sickness shall pass from the earth for good. The orchard will bloom. Someone will play the guitar. Our work will be seen as strong and clean and good. And all that we suffered through having existed shall be forgotten as though we never existed.
Scott Cunningham, founder and director of Oh Miami, a month-long poetry festival there in Miami, entering its final week. Scott, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Nice to have a little distraction there, Robin, from the news of the day, which we continue to follow, of course, in Baltimore, in Nepal, and at the Supreme Court. Meantime, the White House has been hosting the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, but the president has made some comments today on the unrest in Baltimore, saying that his thoughts are with the family of Freddie Gray and that the Department of Justice has opened an investigation. We'll continue to follow that story. here and now. And as we continue to follow the situation in Nepal after that huge earthquake over the weekend, it is worth noting that social media and technology more broadly have played a big role in helping people find their loved ones and support the relief effort. For more on that, let's check in with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is editor of social media for Recode. He's following this. And Kurt, what are some of the big companies getting involved in the relief effort?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. Yes, as you mentioned, a number of big major tech companies are getting pretty heavily involved, including Facebook and Apple and Google. And you've seen a lot of the telecom providers doing the same thing. And so it's been really intriguing to watch kind of Silicon Valley, but the broader tech community in general respond to what's happened in Nepal.
Well, and one of the things that they're doing is offering services, a new service on Facebook, for example, that helps people identify whether their loved ones that are there in Nepal are safe. Tell us a little bit about what Facebook and Google, for that matter, have done there.
So Facebook actually rolled out what's called a safety check back in October. And the feature identifies people geographically who might be in a region where there's been some kind of natural disaster, in this case, obviously, Nepal. And what it does is it prompts those users to mark whether or not they're safe and kind of share that information with their friends on Facebook. And so for those people who are, you know, have loved ones, who have friends in the region, it's a pretty cool feature because it enables them to kind of check in, broadcast to everybody, hey, don't worry, I'm okay, and kind of put everyone else at ease. And Google has something that it's called Google Person Finder, and it's kind of this central hub where people can not only share that, okay, here's information about me and my friends who are safe, but other people who are maybe looking for someone could post and say, I'm looking for, Kurt, and here's what he's like. Can someone please respond if they know that he's safe? And so these two companies are really trying to connect people in the region with those that they care about outside of the region.
Meantime, some of the phone companies of old and maybe some of the communication companies that are newer, like Microsoft, which owns Skype, of course, are offering ways for people to communicate with each other for free.
That's correct. And I think Viber is doing something as well, which is a messaging app. And, you got to appreciate that they're cutting their fees. Like you mentioned Skype. So I believe it's free calls in and out of the Nepal region for Skype. And I think that there's others, maybe Sprint and T-Mobile, I believe, are also doing something similar just in order to again, connect people outside of the region with people in the region. One thing that has been an issue that I've been reading is, of course, there's not a lot of connectivity in Nepal, especially given the earthquake. There's been a lot of infrastructure damage.
Right.
And so there are these nice features, both with the Facebook, the Google, the telcos, but it's not necessarily that everyone has access to internet or to a phone, for that matter, to make these calls. So the tech is there and it's helpful. Doesn't mean that everyone's actually been able to use it.
And allow me to be cynical for a second. These are companies. They are not utilities. They are in the business of making money. Are they really being the good Samaritans that they look like they're being here? Or why do they have an incentive to do this and to offer these services right now?
Well, it's hard to bash them too much for doing good
work. And I'm not bashing them, by the way. I'm just asking.
Sure.
Just asking.
Sorry, I didn't mean you specifically, but what I meant was, they are trying to help, but as you pointed out, these are businesses. I mean, Facebook has users all over the world, and it's trying to capture new users in a lot of emerging markets like Nepal. And so you would be, if I'm Facebook, it is kind of a win-win, and I don't mean to make this insensitively, but you're not only helping, you're doing what you can as a big corporation with a lot of money, with a lot of power to help out in the area, but at the same time, you're showing the people of Nepal who use Facebook and potentially the people who will use Facebook that you care about that community. And I think the same goes for Apple, the same goes for Google. I mean, these are now global corporations that have users and customers all over the world. And so it's in their best interest, of course, to provide for those customers, especially in times of need like this.
And the other thing that some of these tech companies are doing, and I'm talking about Apple and PayPal and Twitter here, are they're allowing people to donate in an easier way. Tell us more about what they're doing there.
Right. So Facebook has a kind of a call to action at the top of the news feed when you log in that's asking people to donate to Nepal. Apple is doing something through iTunes. PayPal is taking donations. And a lot of what they're doing is just trying to make this as simple as possible, really. So whereas a couple years ago, in order to donate, you know, you may have to call, you may have to share your credit card information over the phone, whatever it may be. Now, especially, you know, with iTunes, a lot of our credit cards are already in the system. You simply log in, you hit donate, and voila, you know, your money has been transferred. And I know that a couple of these companies are also donating themselves. Facebook, for example, is matching up to $2 million of donations from users. So it just kind of streamlines the process, makes it a lot easier for people to give their money.
Some of the ways that the tech companies are getting involved in the relief efforts in Nepal and the efforts to find loved ones there. Kurt Wagner, editor of social media for Recode, thank you so much.
Yes, thanks, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.